Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Growth Axiom podcast. Today, I am very fortunate to have Manny on the podcast today. Manny is a ex-B2B marketer in SaaS. He's an ex-angel investor, ex-Cosmos ecosystem participant, was the first hire at Archway, which is an incentivized L1 blockchain that allows developers to capture value for the dApps that they create using sustainable economic models. And now he is working at Optimism and is a awesome dude in the L2 space. So Manny, it's been a pleasure. It's my absolute pleasure to invite you to the podcast. Welcome.
Thank you for that warm intro, everyone. Well, honestly, absolute pleasure to hop on the podcast and let's basically get into it.
All righty, let's do it. Okay, so I don't usually do this for my podcast episodes.
Appreciate
but
it.
I feel like you have a very interesting story of how you got into Web3. And I know we've spoken about it personally. I know we're good friends. So I'd love for you to tell the audience about how you got into Web3 and how that came about.
So I was aware of the space like around 2013, 2014 time period, essentially. Like, just heard about it vaguely. Like, bought a bit of Bitcoin, but completely forgot about it, right? And, you know, the years kind of just kept an eye on it. Didn't really participate beyond like some random Bitcoin I own and some random wallet, which I completely forgot about. And don't worry, it's not life-changing money. So it's nothing crazy like that. But I remember my journey properly into Web3 is down to you, my guy. Like, I remember specifically it was a dinner with me, you, Ben, and a couple of our friends in Shoreditch. So this may have been around like 2018, 2019 time period. And at that same time, as you kind of mentioned in the intro, I was doing angel investing outside of work. So just writing small little checks and kind of supporting different startups, diverse startups in London, particularly around how they can grow and basically acquire initial customers and expand their business. And yeah, like we were having a conversation and like I was laying out my plans for the next year, like, oh, I wanted to put together angel syndicate, which didn't come together. But then you kept on saying to me like, no, you should actually think about doing this on the blockchain, man. I'm like, I know about it, but like you were so excited and then talking about all the things that are coming up. I was like, you know what? That's interesting. I'm gonna pull a pin in that. And then I think when DeFi Summer happened, you messaged me again and said, hey, Big Ed, get involved. So literally, I was like, after DeFi Summer happened, which is terrible timing on my part, to be honest with you. But then after that happened, I was like, okay, cool. You keep harassing me. Let me actually learn a little bit more about this space, right? And so, yeah, I was able to kind of do the research, like understand the different, you know, wallets, applications, ecosystems that popped up. And for me, the analogy I've used even when we had our chats is like, I felt like I still think the tech is still like maybe around 1995 time period. But like, you know, the hype has kind of died down a little bit, but probably like maybe post 2000 tech hype essentially. And then like, for me, there was a lot of like, you know, UX issues, onboarding issues, educational issues and marketing issues I could solve in the space. And, you know, thinking to myself, I was like, with my skill set, having worked in, you know, B2B SaaS and done B2B marketing and just general marketing across a number of different industries, it's like, okay, how can I take my skill set and apply it to this new area, which I see growing to be more commonplace in everyone's lives, essentially. So that's why I kind of took that initiative, learned up and got my first role in the space around 2021. And yeah, I've been in the space ever since, essentially.
Wonderful. I'm honored that to be part of that origin story, and I'm grateful that you actually took me up on that offer to join the space. And off mic, we've spoken about this, and I know it's changed your life, and you're very dedicated to the mission, and that makes me very happy. So, yeah, congratulations for all the success you've had in Web3, and I look forward to seeing you continue to kill it into the decades, right? Because it's a long mission. We're going to be here for a while.
For a while.
Alrighty. Okay, let's get into it. So in your previous life, before Web3, you worked at Black Curve. And Black Curve, maybe you could tell us a bit about Black Curve. It's a pricing startup. How did you... First of all, tell us a bit about Black Curve. What did you learn there? And how does that translate to how you think about pricing in the world of crypto? Because I'm assuming there's a lot of learnings there that you can translate.
Yeah. Just as a disclaimer, the legal team at Optimism would be very happy to say this. Everything I'm talking about is basically just a theoretical. It's not financial advice. Just really out of body legal to people. In terms of my experience at Black Curve, I was the very first marketing hire there as well. So being able to kind of grow with a startup was was basically my first ever foot startup role, essentially. For me, more than anything, that's translated over from, actually, no, let me explain Blackhove. So Blackhove essentially is a tool that allows e-commerce store owners or e-commerce brands basically track the competitors' prices and understand how could they better price their products to be competitive against their competitors. That's essentially what it is. And essentially, as the tool is built up, you kind of have data sources of pricing coming from, you know, your own pricing, the Google Ads that you run to kind of promote your products via Google Ads. You've got your own data that you upload into the platform, as well as like your own competitors' prices as well, to kind of track those to see how you can, you know, underprice them or basically, you know, be a little bit more on the expensive side to eke out some more profit and margin for your business. And essentially, like, being a part of that organization and kind of building up and learning a lot more about pricing is that there's a lot of inefficiencies. A lot of inefficiencies. And again, I know it's the e-commerce side, but it's important to note that there's so many different factors that go into pricing rather than just some random spreadsheet that the intern put together. It's more to do with things. It's obviously seasonality. It's like, you know, what's the typical margin that you've normally got when it comes to a particular product. Also taking into consideration what is actually psychology of your end consumer when you buy that particular price. There's obviously different, you know, psychological pricing and things you could do. You know, you put some, instead of you putting a full number, you put, like, for example, I'm trying to sell pair of headphones, instead of me sending headphones at £100 exactly, I'll sell it for $99.99. Or like you play around with certain numbers to make it seem a lot more attractive. So there's many ways and different elements you can play around with your pricing. I think that was my very first introduction to that, to be honest with you. And especially to give further context, like my educational background is economics. Like, you know, I was doing economics in secondary school, essentially all the way through. And for me, like, pricing was something that you didn't really consider, to be honest with you, but it's such an important lever when it comes to, like, you know, positioning, obviously, like, you know, building your business, and then really thinking out all the way through, okay, how does my pricing be attractive to make sure I'm capturing as much revenue as possible without necessarily, like, you know, engorging on your customers, because you want them to come back and want to be a consistent customer to help your business grow. So all those elements kind of, like, expanding my knowledge around pricing ultimately. And when I look towards, like, the crypto Web3 space, I guess the one thing is really helpful is that when you've seen so many spreadsheets of pricing and you built a product and, like, done a marketing for a product that is specifically focused on e-commerce price tracking, is that you kind of just get desensitized to pricing. So basically, it made me more of a degen. I joke, but it ultimately made me, all the elements, as I mentioned, consider that when it comes to pricing of a particular, you know, token or whatever, right? It's like, there's so many different factors that go into it. Sometimes it really is just, you know, what the market is dictating that you have to take into consideration. But there's so many different other elements that go into it. So you can't always be looking at the number you see on the screen. You have to kind of do the investigative work to say, okay, what is driving this? Is it relevant? Or is it completely out of skew, as we see with many meme coins? So, like, it's so many more factors that go into the online price of a product. You can't just really take it at face value. And that's something which, you know, like, we've talked about it. I've talked about our friends who are trying to enter the space. It's like, look, like, you kind of have to decouple the pricing to the actual everyday technology. And if you don't do that, you basically asking for punishment.
Awesome. Yeah. I think pricing is interesting because I'm not sure if we've spoken about this, but I was running an agency before I got into crypto called Mr. Wolf. And we studied the, you know, the pirate metrics, which I'm sure you're aware of. But for anyone who's listening who isn't, Dave McClure from 500 Startups came up with this framework that is phenomenal and has basically led a lot of the critical thinking around growth for many, many years, even to this day. The framework was launched a decade plus ago. I can't remember exactly when, maybe even longer than that. But essentially you have every business has a funnel and every customer tends to go through that funnel. And the funnel is the following. Acquisition. So you actually acquire the, or maybe let me step back. So there's awareness. So the user is aware of your product or service. Then they get acquired as a customer. They sign up, they pay or whatever. Most of the cases just signing up, especially if you have a freemium product. And then they they are activated. And what that means is there's a core value in every product, right? And in order for a user to truly understand that value, they need to experience it. For example, with Uber, the core value of the product is pushing a button and getting a car show up and actually getting in that car and going to your destination, right? Until you get to that point, you don't really understand the value. You don't appreciate the full value of the product, right? Airbnb is you book a place, you show up, you stay, and you experience the wonderful house that you're staying in. And that's kind of the core value. So you get the activation. And then I believe the next stage after that is retention. So different products have various different levels of retention that, for Airbnb, for example, retention could be every year, every summer or twice a year, the user comes back, the same user comes back to book on Airbnb, right? It's not every day that people book Airbnbs, whereas Uber, maybe it's weekly, right? Some people it's daily, right? But most people probably weekly or monthly, right? And then below that you have revenue after that, which is like, you know, how you price, how much you charge, and, you know, at the point of, making the money. And then the final one, I believe, is referral, which is after a user has gone through all of those steps in the funnel, how do they refer another user such that, you know, it's the whole funnel starts again, but with a new user, right? We call this virality, right? If you have every user who uses your product, if they refer someone else, you have this like natural virality. So we studied this framework and we realized that many companies focused on the awareness, top of funnel, effectively awareness, acquisition, that kind of stuff. And not so much companies didn't really focus on the revenue aspect, right? The retention aspect. So we actually build an agency to help other companies with that. And so I've thought a lot about pricing. I know you have too, working at Black Curve. I see the value of pricing. It's very, very important. And it's actually a growth lever. People don't see it as a growth lever, which is why a lot of companies, when they price their products, they kind of just pull a number out of their ass. Like, it's actually really funny. Like, building this agency, I realized that so many companies just pull a number out of their ass and they don't realize the value of pricing and how that could affect their growth and it's unbelievable the amount of growth you can unlock. And it's much cheaper, just like retention, it's much cheaper to unlock growth there in terms of business growth, as opposed to acquiring a new user, right? Just from a CAC perspective. And CAC, for those who are listening and who don't know, it's customer acquisition cost, right? It's much easier to you have a lower CAC if you improve your pricing. So yeah, I'm excited to continue talking about pricing. I know you're very, very knowledgeable on this. So to contextualize my questions around pricing, when you build a DeFi product or a Web3 product, specifically a protocol, right? I feel like it's different for traditional companies that are building, let's say, for example, like SaaS or like transactional businesses like Coinbase or like a SaaS, like, I don't know, Alchemy or whatever. If you're building a protocol, let's say, for example, like Uniswap, you have this really interesting dynamic where you want to price your fees, effectively your trading fees, such that they're attractive for people to use your protocol. But there's a fear, or there's a danger that you don't have when you're building other types of businesses, where if you price too highly, because your smart contracts are open source, somebody can come in and fork your code, your smart contracts, and build exactly the same thing that you've built, with a new interface. And completely undercut you in terms of pricing. So you have to have this like really sweet, you have to find this perfect sweet spot of asking for the right price and not leaving money on the table, but not asking for too much such that you drive your competitors away. I mean, the perfect example of that is SushiSwap and how SushiSwap came. I mean, it's kind of for a different reason, but like SushiSwap kind of forked Uniswap, added a token, and completely like consumed so much of the Uniswap volume and market. And so I wonder, in your experience, what advice can you give protocol founders who are probably listening to this podcast about how they can price their products and protocols, their protocols effectively, such that they don't get into this weird dilemma with pricing in Web3?
Yes, especially difficult in the space that we operate in, right? Because it's so easy. Like in a traditional world, you can't necessarily, I'm just going to fork, you know, Louis Vuitton and like, bye. I mean, you can with the dupes, and to be fair, some of these dupes are crazy out there. I think when you're looking at a protocol level, it's very tricky, right? Like, I think you kind of it's a fine balance. And I understand, like, you have at a certain point you have to build a business to kind of help, sustain the company and sustain the protocol, and obviously help, continue to add value to the ecosystem, right? So I think when it comes to pricing on protocol level, like, it's really just like make sure you're very clear with what your pricing is to your community. I think when people are blindsided by pricing and there's no like full-on explanation about it, that goes into kind of siren relationship and like opens up the attack vector for a potential fork, right? And I think like having that clarity of like, communication when it comes to pricing is important. And also like it's a race to the bottom is very difficult, right? Because I've seen this happen, and like I literally seen the data on this, like with pretty big e-commerce brands, right? Is that especially in the UK, like some of those brands are kind of falling to the wayside. It's very clear when you're racing to the bottom with your competitors that it basically leads to like a subpar product in the marketplace. But especially in our place where there's transparency built into a lot of the protocols, right? I think by being honest in terms of like we're going to charge X and here's what it's going towards, and being very quite clear on that. And then even if it's like, they might need to become a price increase at a certain time period, using leveraging the community to be quite honest upfront about what that means for the underlying protocol is important as well, right? I think having those lines of communication with your customer is key. And when you before you especially in our space, you have the ability to kind of like begin the conversation before you see a price change. I think a lot of the cost like products that people listen to this back home, or like we've experienced, is like you get the bill for 1 month, and then the next month you see a completely different bill without no explanation, basically. Like I think that's something to kind of consider when it comes to pricing and like manage that expectation, because it's not a sell it and forget it thing, sorry. It's something that you have to iterate on, whether you're building a protocol or not, essentially. So that's why that's my like my 2 pence on that issue, is that make sure the comms is quite clear to your community. And if prices do need to go up, be quite frank and honest about that as well. And like I think if you the com if the communication is there with the community, you hope that the brand equity you've built and understanding and the good products that you've built essentially actually adds a lot of value to people, and they say, you know what, even though I see a fork and I see the lower fees, I'm gonna stick with the protocol that I've been using essentially. So that's my 2 pence on it. I know it's quite contentious in the industry, but that's how I'll probably approach it from that regard. But again, that's why I say pricing isn't just a number on a screen. It's so many other factors that go into it. And I feel like in this day and age, if you're upfront about like things that need to change, but also like seeing it's an iterative process as well, without necessarily being price gougy, I think you should be fine.
Yeah, it's very important. It's not just a number. You have to really think about it. And I mean, just for context, with our agency, what we would do is we would sit down with these companies and help them understand who's using a product, right? Using metrics and customer interviews and all that stuff. How exactly they're using a product, and what specifically, and really get down to brass tacks with a lot of these things, like what specific value that they're getting from the product, and actually put a number to it, right? Because a lot of people don't do that. They just assume that, okay, they're getting X amount of value and therefore I should charge Y. But these like numbers are just quite frankly pulled out of their asses. But when you actually sit down and put data to it, right, you do the customer research, then you actually look at the metrics and you compile that together, the quantitative side and the qualitative side, you can start to build a picture of the value you genuinely produce for these. And it's different for different customers, right? For different products and different customers. Then you can start to build pricing that really hits that sweet spot. And transparency, as you said, is paramount. And I noticed this in particular with the companies I worked with that are more developer facing. If you're a developer facing product, I mean, you should be transparent with your pricing, period, any company. But it is particularly important if you're building a developer facing product, because with developer facing products, most often than not, they can do it themselves. But they're using your product or service or protocol because you're providing X amount of value to them, and it just makes sense. But ultimately, most developer products, well, not all, but most developer products can be rebuilt by the developer themselves. They have the skills, right? So in that case, you have to be very clear about your pricing. And I would urge companies and founders listening to this to tilt towards a usage-based pricing model, which is what AWS is known for, right? It's very important that you really charge people only what they get from the product in terms of usage. So Yeah, definitely. I love the insights there. Let's switch gears a little bit because I want to talk a bit about your experience in Optimism and L2s, which is where you are right now. Just a high lay of the land. What is it like in the L2 ecosystem? You've got Optimism, Arbitrum, Polygon, all these other projects. Obviously, you're working at Optimism. So I'm curious to know, what are your general views on the landscape and what makes Optimism unique? Actually, on top of that, if you could, after that question, if you could answer for the people listening to this who are going to be developers building and making decisions as to where they build their where they launch their protocol or their dApp or whatever, almost like pitch Optimism. Why is Optimism better than Arbitrum, Polygon, et cetera, et cetera? I'd love for you to do that and for the audience to hear that.
So your question about like why Optimism gets everyone else, do you want me to start a war?
Okay, maybe not a war. I'm a man of peace.
I'm a man of peace.
You're gonna get along together, like... but I know how hot the L2 ecosystem is. So yeah, if you could pitch it in a way that doesn't incite a war, that would be great.
I'm a man of peace as well. I guess the way I view Optimism, right, is that it's transacting and doing a lot of good on L1s is on Ethereum L1 is very, very expensive. Like if you're the end user, if you're a builder, it's extremely expensive. Essentially a bunch of L2s, like especially Optimism's case, like we basically try to make it incredibly cheap for you to, transact and build within an ecosystem, and that allows for so many different applications to come through at a scale that's like you've not normally imagined. Essentially, like, with Optimism, like, we are rolled up, we have kind of helped move transactions from L1 to L2 and move them very quickly at far cheaper rates and a bigger scale. And essentially, like, I think what makes Optimism very unique is like from the DNA, the exception of Optimism, the focus is built is on basically, impact equals profit, right? And that meme, you may have seen it populated around, or people kind of say that with retroactive public goods funding, RetroPGF in short. It's essentially like, how can you build a self-sustaining ecosystem that continuously rewards the people who contribute the most positive impact? An example in the real world would be like, people, a local community center who provides like, free education, free, schooling and like opportunities for kids locally. But especially on chain, it's like, the people who like the one or two people who created tooling to kind of help an ecosystem, educators, content creators, builders who are focused on infrastructure, all these things which might not sound very sexy to an angel investor or to a VC, essentially, but without those key contributors who are taking time out of their own lives, who are basically doing that on the side and obviously handing in job on the side, the ecosystem would flourish, and, for Optimism, in Optimism's case, it's like, we generate a crap ton of transactions, and from the sequencing fees, a portion of that goes to RetroPGF. So right now there's a portion of OP tokens that which are governance tokens that are allocated towards RetroPGF. For the last, we had three rounds now essentially. So the first one was for $1 million, and second one was for 10 million OP, and the third one, which closed up, was for 30 million OP. And essentially that acts as not only as a way to kind of bring more builders into our ecosystem and separate us from the competition, but also it just really spotlights like the scale of contribution that would not be possible if it wasn't for people taking time out their own energy to reward back to the community, right? And it's something that, having come from the Cosmos ecosystem, it's very tricky to kind of get that support, especially with everything that is like, happening so quickly and like, a lot of people doing great things, but necessarily have the resource to continue to do those great things, right? And I feel like, programs like RetroPGF and like them are very, very important to make sure like, ecosystem continues to thrive, right? And ultimately, like, it's definitely proved its use case, and hopefully one day, touch wood, it becomes something that's very prevalent in our everyday lives, is that, the good that you add to your local community or your local ecosystem gets rewarded, essentially. And I think that's what's like separates Optimism. It's in the name, essentially. It separates Optimism from everyone else. And like, we're here to kind of spread Ether's Phoenix and like, spread the goodness and spread the vibes, and ultimately.
Fantastic. I love that you touched on many things there, but in particular, the RetroPGF aspect, the retro public goods funding aspect. It's certainly something that has impressed me with the Optimism ecosystem. The fact that there's a big effort towards funding public goods. And you mentioned there that the hope, touch wood, would be that this will be more prevalent. And I genuinely believe that Optimism has led the charge and other ecosystems are taking note. I think that other ecosystems, I mean, I won't say specifics, but I'm seeing a lot of other ecosystems thinking about implementing retroactive public goods funding in their ecosystems, because it's amazing. It's phenomenal. You have it, like, as you said, if you don't fund these public goods, then the for-profit companies and all of the great things that come on top of these ecosystems won't be able to have, like, all of the libraries, all of the education, the tooling, all of this stuff, right? Like, it's imperative to support that. And so, yeah, it's incredible to see that with Optimism. Let's switch gears on that. And for reference, 30 million OP is $110 million, if I'm not mistaken, at the time of distribution. So it's not negligible numbers that we're talking about. Genuinely, $110 million directed towards public goods funding in the Optimism ecosystem. It's incredible. Like, I've not seen things at this scale before. It's genuinely inspiring. So I want to ask you a few questions about that particular initiative, Retro PGF. What are the biggest learnings? Because you guys are distributing such a huge amount of money to public goods. What are the biggest learnings that you've attained? And how can you teach others who would like to bring Retro PGF to their ecosystems about those learnings and, you know, how they could avoid mistakes that potentially you guys have made or, you know, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, I think... So just to give some context for, like, you know, Retro PGF, like, so the recent announcement of grant recipients was for round three. So the previous two rounds, I think those retros are actually on our Mirror. So our Mirror blog, essentially. So you can actually dig those up if you want to go into extreme detail. But it's kind of to summarize those, right? It's just the scale, right? Like, the scale and distribution of contribution is definitely a massive learning for us, essentially. And also just, like, raising awareness for Retro PGF. Like, I know, like, I think people may have seen on Twitter when it came down to the final couple of days before people could submit their entry for round three. Basically, Twitter was ablaze with people trying to, like, you know, raise awareness for their particular submission to hopefully get, you know, enough votes from the badge holders. So basically, like, if I take a step back, basically, anyone's able to submit, if they contribute towards the Optimism ecosystem, they're able to fill an application form, put around, and kind of demonstrate your impact. Hopefully, there's, like, you know, some statistics and, you know, basically to demonstrate that you've added positive impact to the ecosystem, right? And basically, badge holders who are not part of the Optimism team, so it's completely separate. We don't have no influence over the whole process, so it's completely fair. There's certain criteria that they'll vote on, basically, and it'll attach a certain number of votes to your particular application, right? And then you have to reach a quorum. I think it's about 17 votes, if I remember correctly. And basically from there, you would be entered to basically receive a grant, and then the actual grant is actually weighed on a bunch of different calculations to make sure it's even, an even distribution across the board, right? And, you know, that whole process, like, you know, in terms of generating awareness for your particular application, I think that's definitely one learning experience, is that, you know, want to make sure the batch holders feel like they can do their work, and, like, they have to go through, like, a lot of applications, right? So it's not something where it's, like, only 30 people applying. If 501 grantees were recipients last time, like, you can imagine the number of submissions that come through ultimately, right? So the batch holders have to go through that process on their own. And then ultimately, just, like, I think the lesson is, like, that it's just so much contribution happening. It's a case of, okay, how can Retro PGF is on the third iteration, right? Like, initially it was just, like, initial tests, and the second one was a really big jump. And the third one was like, okay, this is something that everyone's taking seriously across the board, where, you know, you hit me up, like, a couple of my friends hit me up and say, hey, what, how much OP? So, so ultimately, like, you know, dealing with the scale, and that's just, like, you know, some stuff to happen in the background, or, like, you know, if you have so many submissions, you really gotta make sure the process of making sure everyone gets their fair due is solidified. B is, like, you don't necessarily have to focus on the scale of it, right? It's like, you know, if you're gonna do your own, you know, retroactive public goods funding in your own ecosystem, it's a case of, like, you know, why are we doing this? Like, I think if you distill it down to that and really be really smart in terms of the messaging and ultimately the awareness of it, because the worst thing you do is, like, someone who could potentially benefit from the program who does not aware about it. I think that's definitely something to consider if you're going to run your own program essentially in your own ecosystem. And I think just taking an iterative approach, like, you know, we're on our third one, definitely going to our fourth one essentially. And with the fourth one, there's going to be like, you know, a public retro and internal retro about, okay, what could be done better? What could be streamlined? How can we, you know, improve awareness? Some of these other things that take into consideration to make sure that, you know, as many people know it's available, as many people can participate, and just clarity on like what the whole process is in terms of like, you know, you becoming a grantee winner, and then you progress through KYC and all the other goodness, and hopefully you receive your OP grant essentially. So that's like my overall summation of that. And I know there's gonna be a more detailed retro for round three. I'm not sure exactly when, but it'll be coming out relatively soon essentially. So keep your eyes peeled for that. But yeah, ultimately, like, it's just a lot of learnings in terms of the scale, the messaging, really thinking through of like, okay, how can we benefit everyone? How can this benefit the broader ecosystem, and be really diligent about the process as well? Like, it's very easy to just slap up a landing page and say, oh, we're giving away tokens. Like, but why? And I think why I'm thinking from a sustainable angle will help you really think through, okay, will basically help you avoid lots of pitfalls around just doing things just to get a big number out there, but actually doing things that actually has long-term sustainable impact, and then try to like do research on this. Like, okay, how can we continue that over the long run?
Yeah, sustainability is paramount. It's imperative. You must think about sustainability. And I like that you guys are thinking about that. I also like the fact that you guys are making the retros, the learnings public, you know, putting the mirror post out there. And I've put notes down here to say that I will link that in the description for those who want to check it out. And I'm elated to hear that the next round four, there's actually going to be a public retro. So actually the act of doing the retrospective will be out in the public, not just done internally, and then kind of the results will be public. Is that correct? Am I?
Oh no, I meant to clarify. Like, so the round three that just happened, there's going to be a retro about that coming out very soon.
Correct. And then round four, there'll be a public retrospective. As in, like, instead of that being done internally, that will be done. There'll be one externally and then one internally. Is that correct, or am I misunderstanding that?
I know, misunderstanding. Yeah. So round four will come at a later date, but like before round four happens, there's always like a proper detailed retro about that. And then Jonas, who basically is the NF, who is the retro PGF lead, basically probably may have hop on a few different, you know, community groups, kind of share learnings and gain some feedback as well. And also there's a feedback form if they have any feedback, like the Jonas and the rest of the team are very, very open to get, you know, feedback on how the process could be iterated. So that's kind of factors into everything.
Amazing. Thank you so much for clarifying. Also, something that I came across that you might not be aware of, you may be aware of it, I'm not sure. I find it to be very interesting is, and this is a fantastic example of how optimism is leading the charge here and kind of inspiring various different ecosystems and encouraging them to bring retroactive public funding to their ecosystem. There's a project called Easy Retro PGF. Is this something you've heard of?
Is that from Kevin via Gitcoin?
Kevin yes, Iwaki yes. at Gitcoin, correct, yes. Yeah. And this is amazing. So for those of you who are listening and don't know about Easy Retro PGF, so because Optimism has led the charge and created this amazing initiative and inspired people, Kevin Iwaki, who is a longtime player in terms of encouraging appropriate funding for open source development, He and his team have developed this thing called Easy Retro PGF.xyz. We'll link it in the description, that allows people to take the UIs that Optimism have built. They effectively have, and if I'm not mistaken, in collaboration with the Optimism Foundation, worked on building tooling around Retro PGF and have open sourced that and are encouraging people to take that technology, that software, and use it in their own ecosystems to have their own versions of Retro PGF. And that is like a fantastic example of how these ideas are beginning to proliferate and tap into other ecosystems. So that's amazing. I will link that in the chat so that others can have a look there. Okay, we're coming into the final aspect of this podcast, and I realize this initiative, these last two initiatives are quite large, so we may have to, you know, speak about it at a high level and then maybe bring you back on again to go into detail. You're working on the We Love Art initiative, and I believe that's very fascinating. There's a lot of learnings there. It's like the retro PGF. It's at a significant scale. So for the audience who are listening, please tell us a bit about what We Love Art is as an initiative and what it is, how it got started, and how it's evolved over time, and potentially how folks can get involved.
Yeah, absolutely. So We Love the Art basically kicked off in November 8th, if I'm correct. Yes, November 8th. It's been a while. So basically kicked off November 8th, and it's a collaboration. It's an internal collaboration at Altruism. So work quite closely with Binji, who's NFT lead, to help, you know, wrangle amazing partners and judges to participate in contests. Essentially, we're allowing artists who do mints from November 8th, who did mints from November 8th to January 8th, to basically like submit those mints. And those mints can be across like, you know, OP mainnet, which is, you know, our mainnets, and, you know, Base and Zora, across a multitude of different marketplaces that were mentioned on the website. And I'll ping you the website link as well, so you can add that to the notes. And essentially from there, you're able to submit your art to be judged by an amazing panel of judges. So that's a mixture of people across, you know, four different categories of judges. So we've got music, AI art, generative art, and one-of-ones. And essentially, all these different artists who submitted were able to kind of like, you know, allow their creative expression to kind of come on chain, essentially. So it was definitely a mixture of people who are, you know, established, who are up and coming within the space, and also people who've never minted before, purely because, you know, the prize pool was quite substantial. So it's about, 1.2 million OP is a prize pool. Essentially, for each category, there are four awards. So the top prize for each category is 50k OP, and then there's 20k OP, 7k OP, and then 1k OP prizes. And then for each category, there'll be 47 winners in total, and two top prize 50k OP prize winners. And the price breakdown and all the details are on the website. That'll be linked as well. So yeah, like running that contest, you know, ideating it, you know, leading the marketing on that, launching it, it's been an endeavor to say the very least. Yeah, lots of excitement. And then we basically, submissions close at the top end of January, about 7,000 plus submissions altogether from so many different countries, from, you know, countries in Asia, Africa, across the US and Europe and South America as well. Like, it's pretty global. And it's been told to me, and so far no one's fact checked, like, no one's kind of counted. Apparently, it is the biggest on-chain art contest and digital art contest ever in terms of scalability, prize pool, and prizes available, essentially. So yeah, like being able to kind of execute that is really kind of awesome, because we're kind of doing two things, right? We're allowing artists to kind of get the spotlight, right? Who don't normally get the spotlight, especially in these, you know, bear market sentiments. It's kind of really tough to be a creative. But it also kind of just spotlight the amazing partners that we work with, like, you know, Base and Zora as amazing, amazing super chain partners. And then all the different marketplaces we're working with, like OpenSea, Manifold, Zora again, like Sound, all the way to, like, you know, the amazing judges have been really helpful in terms of like raising the profile for the contest, like, you know, Faith Love, People Pleaser, you know, Zeneca, Maz. There's so many different people across their, you know, their time of taking out energy to kind of, you know, really make sure creatives know about this. So right now, like, we're in the middle of the whole judging period and basically like continuing that forward, essentially. So yeah, looking to announce winners over the next couple of weeks, and then basically kind of get out to the people to say, hey, look, like, this is, these are amazing creatives who are doing amazing things, and ultimately just trying to make sure that, you know, they're represented as well when it comes to on-chain, you know, activations that happen, on-chain activity that happens, because you need the cultural element and you need things to happen on-chain for you to grow your chain. And also to kind of like help people who create these amazing products and applications kind of get out to as many users as possible, right? So that's twofold, right? It's two for one, maybe. That's why we did this particular campaign, and, you know, the success of it, definitely we'll be doing another one, not soon, because I need a break. But basically we'll be doing like a second version of this, and like off the back of doing, again, similar to Reg BGF, because the first one happened, the second one happened, a lot of people caught attention, and then the third one's happened, and some of the tooling you've mentioned come off the back of it. Now that we've done We Love the Art, we're gonna, you know, it's gonna wrap up, and then there's a number of different community-led programs that people are working on are going to come through, and even some stuff that we're going to do to kind of profile some of the winners as well. We'll be doing that as well. And yeah, just a lot of energy on the creative side, right? And I think it's important that, you know, that's harnessed in the right way to basically help people who are established or people who are up and coming and people who are brand new to space to find a home on the super chain when it comes to their creativity and make that as seamless as possible. And yeah, like I'm excited to kind of wrap it up, to be honest with you, but also I'm more excited to see what the post Wheel of the Art, you know, programs are going to come in place, and like obviously happy to support that all the way through.
Phenomenal, man. I'm very excited too. It's going to be a very exciting next couple of weeks and months. I want to wrap up with a final question that talks a bit about ecosystem. So what I want for the people who are listening to this, you know, think of them as protocol founders, product founders in the Web3 space. They're trying to build ecosystems around their products and protocols. And Optimism has clearly done a phenomenal job at doing that, right? They've built, like, you guys have built a wonderful, generative, positive, optimistic, pun intended, ecosystem on top of the technology. And so if you want to wrap with the final kind of few thoughts for people on what they can learn about how to build a thriving ecosystem on top of their protocols and their products, we would love to hear that. So by all means, spread some alpha and some wisdom.
Alpha and wisdom, I'll take that. I think ultimately it's building together, man. Like I think if you try to take the approach of like, you know, who are these people building on top of me? I'm the protocol, I'm the big shot in town, I'm the sheriff in town. You're not gonna last very long, mate. I'll tell you that much. I think the approach to take is to basically be collaborative, and like building together is definitely ethos that, you know, we take to heart. Our Optimism, like, you know, on my side, I'm always trying to support the different projects that reach out for, you know, marketing support as much as possible. And then on the partner side of things, okay, how can we work together to basically leverage what you've built? And like get that out into as front as many people as possible, right? Like, you know, if you look for We Love the Art, like, you know, yes, I know it's a lot of OP, but at the same time, like what really made people stand up and pay attention was that we, myself and Binge, you worked to basically figure out, okay, who can we target to basically make sure that this is a place where all the partners need to be involved, right? And the same could be applied to if you're literally just building out your protocol, right? Like who are similar projects or founders within the space who I could collaborate with that can shine out a spotlight in terms of what I'm building? And how can I help elevate what they're doing as well? It's basically you have to act like you are running a sports agency or talent agency or creative agency. You have a client who's a creative wizard. You have to figure out, okay, what can I offer them that's going to separate me from all other agencies and like really try to go to bat for them? Like if you're a protocol, like, okay, what can you do on the BD side? What can you do on the marketing side? Or what can we do when we bring both our audiences together to benefit each other, right? And not just do one and done, like, okay, we announce a partnership on Mirror or on Medium and then call it a day. It's like, no, like, how can we continue to build together? How can you think about your entire roadmap of your product launches, tie that to marketing launches, and like connect that with different people within your ecosystem and see what they're doing as well? I think if you take that collaborative community focused approach of growing, it basically positions your ecosystem as the one that, okay, these guys are building together. There's a collective shared vision that everyone's bought into. That's why the Superchain vision and meme is like so powerful, because, you know, you've got the likes of Base building on us now, building on us now. You've got, you know, Mode recently announced, and there's a few others coming. So like it's so much energy around it, and it just makes it easier for people to buy into that. And you can do that if you are establishing an ecosystem from the very start. You just have to be very thoughtful about being open to collaboration rather than a lot of the siloing and the tribalism that happens, where you see in the space where everyone's kind of just doing their own thing, where actually if you come together in some way, shape or form, you can actually benefit everyone all together, right? So that's generally how like I would top level, high level view advice protocol founders and founders overall, is like, how can you be collaborative, right? Like I think is, I'm not saying you're gonna work with everybody and you're gonna get on with everybody. I'm very aware of that. But at the same time, if you kind of default to be collaborative and open and try to work together, I think you'll benefit you in the long run.
Wonderfully said. When I think of Optimism, I think of an ecosystem that is insanely open and collaborative. I heard a lot of open and collaborative in your answer there, and I can't think of a single ecosystem that is as positive sum, as regenerative as Optimism. And it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast and share your wisdom about all of the great things that you're doing in the Optimism ecosystem. And so I would love to do this again. Thank you so much. And any final words?
Honestly, thank you, Abel, for having me on. I appreciate the time. Thank you for having me on the podcast. Yeah, honestly, it's time flown by. Would love to come on again to kind of dive more deeply into like ecosystem growth and like ideas around that. More than happy to share on that regard. And I guess, you know, final words is like, hey, just follow Optimism on Twitter. We've got a lot of things cooking that is going to be coming up soon. And as a former waiter and bartender myself, you know, yes, chef, let's get cooking.
What a wonderful way to end the podcast. Thank you, Manny. I'll see you very soon, my friend. Take care.
Appreciate it.